Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, and joined as always by our diplomatic correspondent and senior contributing editor, Lahav Harkov. And this week I want to apologize up front if I cough in the middle of this recording, or if my voice sounds a little off. It's because, yes, COVID has struck in the Katz household. It's spread like wildfire. Started with two of our kids, then I got it, then my wife got it, then a third kid got it. So we're having a lot of fun here in isolation in Jerusalem with flu symptoms, coughing, and lots of tea.
Well, you sound okay so far, and we're glad you're still able to join us, and hopefully you'll feel better soon. It has not yet struck the Harkov household, COVID, but it's pretty crazy that it hasn't, because a lot of my relatives have it right now, and I just feel like it's a matter of time, even though I am careful. So, first of all, and most important, wishing you a speedy recovery.
I think, Lahav, that when you have kids who are going to school, like you do or and I do, as much as we adults protect ourselves, once the kids get it and bring it into the house, it's a done deal. It's a fait accompli.
Yeah. And I mean, my kids are so little that they are not really able to do anything careful. I mean, my 5-year-old told me that they tell them not to like hug each other in preschool, which part of me almost wishes that they wouldn't say that because I want them to be as normal as possible. But even without that, like, preschoolers are like gross. Like their bodily fluids are everywhere. There's no way to keep them apart.
Everywhere. Yeah, I remember those old days. Yeah. But there's plenty going on. And Lahav, I actually wanted to get your input on, you know, the Whoopi Goldberg scandal, the amnesty report. And let me just throw out there a theory or a question. Do we not play this stuff up too much? Do you think that maybe Israel or the pro-Israel community might cause itself, I'm not going to say damage, but it's like, it's almost, I don't know, like how much do we have to give credence to every person who says something stupid?
Look, it's a really difficult balance, I would say. I think Amnesty and Whoopi Goldberg are not the same, but Amnesty, I think they appeal to different groups of people. So Amnesty is like mostly a very respected human rights organization, and it's appealing to like an elite segment of the public, both in government and, you know, diplomats and academics. And so it is important to try to, and those are the those segments sort of end up getting in the elite news, right? Like, I don't think this Amnesty report would have come out and not be picked up by, you know, the New York Times, the Guardian, whatever. And while I don't really think Israel gets a fair say in either of those publications, it's important to respond because they are read by very many millions of people. And Whoopi Goldberg and The View, I think, appeals to a different segment of the population, but also very popular show viewed by millions of people. And it was important to say something else. I mean, we should tell our readers, our listeners, chances are they know, but maybe we should get into the specific things. Like Whoopi Goldberg, you know, they were talking about this situation where there's a school in Tennessee that wants to take the book Mouse off of its curriculum. Mouse is a graphic novel about the Holocaust where the Nazis are cats and the Jews are mice. And they talked about there sort of being nudity and violence and that it's inappropriate for children. And some of the things they said, I don't have the exact quotes in front of me, were a little bit ridiculous. You know, like if you want to teach kids in middle school about the Holocaust, it's going to be very difficult. It's not, you know, an easy topic to talk about. You know, and arguably you could use a different book and not Mouse, but this became a very big scandal because there were certain things that made it sound like basically they wanted to sanitize Holocaust education. So Whoopi Goldberg and the other women on The View were talking about this. And then for whatever reason, Whoopi Goldberg said, the Holocaust is not about race. It's about man's inhumanity to man. And when Joy Behar and Anna Navarro were like correcting them and saying like, no, the Nazis saw Jews as an inferior race and they wanted to kill them all, Whoopi Goldberg was like, no, it's just white people and more white people. And then she realized people were mad at her. So she went on the Colbert Show to explain herself. And she said that it was white people fighting white people. And to me, like, I just, like, what has she learned or read or seen in movies about the Holocaust that made her think that Jews were fighting Germans? You know, I mean, my grandfather was in the U.S. Army. He fought Germans, but not the Jews that were in the Holocaust. Like, that's in Israel, there's an expression that it's fallen out of favor because it sounds a little bit like victim blaming. But the expression in Israel for a long time was that they went like sheep to the slaughter. Like, this isn't in two armies fighting. So that was infuriating. And then the other thing that it's not about race and that Jews are just white people. Like, I understand why someone who is not so familiar with the situation would think in America Jews are just white people, but in the Holocaust it's very clear that Jews were not considered white people no matter what the color of their skin is.
Have you read this John Podhoretz op-ed in the New York Post?
I have not read it yet. I like John Podhoretz, but I haven't read it yet.
About how Whoopi Goldberg took the name Goldberg, right? That's not her original name. Little did I know, I always thought that was her name. No, her original name was Johnson. And she changed her name sometime in the 1980s to Goldberg, which is a Jewish name, right? It's not a non-Jewish name, which is just adds to the silliness of this whole story.
Yeah, I always thought, like, I don't know, she was adopted by a Jewish family or she was briefly married to someone Jewish. Like, I just didn't, like, bother to look into it that much. And now with this whole scandal, people are talking about it. Then not only did she take the name Goldberg, but that apparently she or her mother thought it would help her in show business to sound Jewish. So it's like, not only did she adopt a Jewish last name, but she adopted it for an anti-Semitic reason. I still don't think that she was malicious in what she said about the Holocaust. I think that she's very deeply ignorant and, like,
right. But that's my point, is that there's a lot. Look, are there stupid people out there? There's plenty of stupid people out there. Do stupid people say stupid things? Yes, all the time, right? Is Holocaust education, if someone doesn't know and if they're ignorant, are they going to say something stupid? Yes. Is America now with woke culture so hypersensitive to anything that has to do with race and to color of skin? So whether you're white, then it has to be a white issue. And if you're black, then it's a black issue. So everything is put into that prism. Also, that's a disturbing phenomenon that's also taking place, right? So all in all together, I think that what we have is just everything stupid that could happened here.
Yes. But I do think that it was important and it was very good that Jonathan Greenblatt, the president of the ADL, came on The View and he spoke very well about what was the problem with what Whoopi Goldberg said and what the Holocaust was really about and why it was a uniquely horrifying and terrible event in human history.
You see, Hitler's ideology, the Third Reich, was predicated on the idea that the Aryans, the Germans, were a, quote, master race, and the Jews were a subhuman race. It was a racialized anti-Semitism. Now, that might not fit exactly or feel different than the way we think about race in 21st century America, where primarily it's about people of color. But throughout the Jewish people's history, they have been marginalized, they have been persecuted, they have been slaughtered, in large part because many people felt they were not just a different religion, but indeed a different race.
But a lot of people are also criticizing the ADL this week because they changed their definition of racism, basically to say that racism is something perpetrated by white people against other groups of people or against people of color. And a lot of Jews are upset about that because, well, you know, we're talking about the Holocaust. That was definitely perpetrated by white people. But, you know, there are anti-Semitic events happening all the time that are by people who are not white. I mean, also white supremacists, but, you know, also the Colleyville was hostage event situation was, you know, an Arab. No, he's Pakistani, I think, Muslim man. And there was, you know, that Hanukkah stabbing a few years ago in Jersey City that were by black Hebrew Israelites. You know, it's unfortunately anti-Semitism is, you know, all over the place. And it's not only white people. And for the ADL, which is really the most prestigious organization in America fighting anti-Semitism, to change its definition of racism to basically cut anti-Semitism out of it, is deeply problematic. And so while I appreciate that Greenblatt went on The View and he said all the right things, I think that he needs to adjust that because that gives people the wrong idea.
You know, as someone, I'm originally from Chicago and my father still lives there. So I've been following when he sends me all the time. There's been a series of anti-Semitic attacks over the last week in the West Rogers Park neighborhood of Chicago, where there's a large Jewish community. And just yesterday, the alderman for that neighborhood, Deborah Silverstein, came out with a statement and said that the suspect in custody is Shahid Hussein, right? Also, that's not white. That's not a white person carrying out a racist crime. So I don't know if that fits into that ADL definition, but whatever. I mean, I wonder also, you know, Amnesty, we saw a fierce Israeli response before the report even came out. And I've heard some people who have said, you know, yeah, it's going to be in the New York Times. It's going to be in, it's going to be published elsewhere. These people already think that we're in apartheid state. What do we need to play this thing up and give it so much, amplify the reach of this report, which is clearly anti-Israel?
I don't know that the average like American liberal person thinks Israel is an apartheid state. And so I think that, you know, and that's who's reading the New York Times. But people reading the New York Times, like, is split. Like, I'm sure there are people who are pretty far left who think Israel's an apartheid state or read the Times. But I think it's important to let, you know, to have our say. Should we continue obsessing over it for weeks? No. But I think it was important that, you know, the embassies put out their statements and went on TV and responded if it was already going to be on TV and things like that. I also think that the foreign ministry is looking at this year as sort of like the year of apartheid. And I wrote a long article about this a few weeks ago about things that Foreign Minister Lapida said about it, that they're expecting a whole bunch of events to happen this year in which Israel will be accused of apartheid and more serious than amnesty. Things in the UN, there's this sort of permanent investigation of the situation in Gaza and of the recent conflict in May. And strangely, because it's not exactly the mandate, although it has a very broad mandate, but the foreign ministry expects that committee to call Israel an apartheid state. They're worried that the Palestinians are going to appeal to the International Court of Justice to determine whether Israel is an apartheid state or not. All kinds of things like that that are more serious than amnesty. And so I think they're sort of gearing up for this fight over the course of the next year.
What do you make, Lahav? I thought what was interesting to me was the U.S. response, right? We saw the U.S. ambassador to Israel who said that it's absurd. We saw comments by Ned Price, the spokesperson at the State Department, who also came out and was very critical of the amnesty report. And what was interesting to me was the same week that the State Department was also very critical of Israel for the death of the Palestinian American Omar Saad already 2 weeks ago in the West Bank after he was detained by soldiers, and he died apparently of a heart condition. He was left outside and he was blindfolded and gagged at one point, and the soldiers left him and he had passed out because it seems of his heart condition, which might have been brought on by the incident. And some soldiers, two officers have been fired. The battalion commander has been reprimanded by the IDF chief of staff. But at the same time that they're saying that investigation wasn't enough, they're pushing back on the apartheid claim, which shows that the Biden administration is walking a delicate balance, I'd say, here between apartheid claims and a feeling that the Israeli investigation into the Omar Saad death is not enough. How do you understand that?
Okay, so first of all, with the apartheid claim, you know, I'm glad that they're pushing back, but I think that they did it in a way that's a little bit flippant. I mean, the ambassador to Israel, Tom Nides, his tweet says, I have it in front of me, says, come on, this is absurd. That is not language that we have used and will not use. It just seemed very flippant to me, like, come on, this is absurd. Like, can you give a somewhat more in-depth response to why this is not appropriate language? Now, it's not their job to be doing Israel's PR, but like, if you're taking a position, like, at least, you know, explain it, describe it, rather than just being like, this is absurd.
I hear that, but the flip side is that he could have not said anything. So the fact is he did say something. I mean, you know.
For sure, but I don't know. Definitely the previous administration would have said more, I think. And I think that any administration that wants to say that they're a friend of Israel, and I think they are a friend of Israel, but I think that they should have done more. I really think they should have done more. Now, about this situation with the with the Palestinian man Omar Asad, I mean, it was just clearly the soldiers did the wrong thing. Somebody died on their watch needlessly, and I think that there should be a thorough investigation. But I do think that, you know, firing these people or dismissing these people is accountability. I don't know. I you know, on the one hand, they make this statement and it's critical of Israel. On the other hand, I felt like it could have been much worse. Like, it could have been very critical of Israel. And I think that this is very boilerplate.
I think it shows that they are trying to walk a tightrope here with Israel, right? They don't want to be overly critical. Now, what that stems from is an interesting question of itself. And then maybe that ties into our interviewee this week, who is David Friedman, the former U.S. ambassador to Israel during the Trump administration, on the occasion of the publication of his new book, Sledgehammer, which comes out next week and can be purchased on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and everywhere books can be found, I would say. But we spoke to David about also kind of things that he did as ambassador, the big achievements of the moving of the embassy to Jerusalem and what process that set off, and questions about the Abraham Accords, but also about the difference between, I would say, the tone of the Trump administration and the tone of the Biden administration, which you were kind of just hinting to.
Yeah. And just the book, I read it over the course of a Shabbat. It's like a short, light, like, you know, very quick read. And I did enjoy it. It was very interesting. And we're going to have some news stories in the Jerusalem Post for previewing what was in the book. You know, it's very different from the previous book that came out. There's a book by an Israeli journalist that came out in Hebrew. A lot of people talking about, this isn't like a policy book. It's very much like David Friedman's memoir of his time as an ambassador. And there's a lot of really interesting details there about his relationship with former President Trump, and his relationship with Netanyahu and other figures in Israel. And we get into some of that in the interview.
Lots of books coming out. There's the Barak Ravid book you mentioned. There's David Friedman's book. David Friedman's senior advisor, Aryeh Lightstone, has a book, which is also coming out in a couple of months. I've heard that Ron Dermer, Israel's former ambassador to Washington, is also, who was there for a bunch of years, is also working on a book. Jared Kushner has a book that's coming out. So we're going to be getting a lot of books about Israel-U.S. relations in the coming year, probably.
Well, you know, if any of those authors are listening, they're welcome to come on our podcast.
This will be the podcast for Israel-U.S. Books. And with that, here is David Friedman, the former U.S. ambassador to Israel, and about his new book, Sledgehammer. Here we go. So, former American ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, it's great to have you with us on the Jerusalem Post podcast. And we're talking ahead of the release of your new book, Sledgehammer, which is coming out in just a few days. And I mean, before we kind of dive into what the book is, and I think a lot of our readers and listeners at the Jerusalem Post know you quite well from over the years and all of your lots of activities while you were here as ambassador. You got a lot done, and we'll get into some of that. But if you gave us an overview, what does the book go into? Because, you know, some people might not know, for example, it starts with stuff that doesn't have to do with your ambassadorship or diplomacy, right?
Sure. So, And thanks, Yaakov, for having me, and thank you, Lahav, as well. I know you're there. So, you know, Yaakov, I think, you know, to really understand the story of our foreign policy with regard to Israel, I think it's important to sort of understand the policymakers. You know, the president was kind and gracious enough to give me, you know, a long runway to help guide Israeli policy. Obviously, I took instructions from him, but he gave me a large amount of authority, probably more than a typical ambassador. And so I thought, you know, it was important at the outset to really give people a sense of the relationship I had with the president, how it developed, and also a little bit about myself, you know, how I developed the views that I developed. And, you know, I don't think I'm unique for someone my age in terms of the views I developed from, you know, from my parents' generation. And then, you know, if you think about it for a second, you know, what I think people may not appreciate is, you know, there are thousands and thousands of us, in, you know, observant Jews, committed Jews, religious or not, may not be the most important variable, but certainly committed to Israel. And, you know, we'll spend countless hours talking about what Israel should do, what Israel shouldn't do, what the U.S. should do, what the U.S. shouldn't do. You know, lots and lots of us engage in those debates. We go to the synagogue on Shabbat. We argue about it, you know, afterwards at the Kiddush. Well, you know, one of those guys, you know, one of those, you know, thousands of guys was plucked up from that world and was actually given, you know, the opportunity to actually, instead of talking about it and arguing about it, actually do something about it, to actually have a enormous influence on U.S.-Israel policy and to execute, you know, major changes in that policy. And so, you know, it's never happened before. You know, I don't know if it'll ever happen again, but I think just the juxtaposition of events and how it came about, I think it needs a, you know, it needs a bunch of pages up front to sort of put that a little bit into context.
I mean, it's funny that you say that because I always thought and would talk about with sort of my sister, that, you know, there's so many people in the Trump administration who are like modern Orthodox people from the New York, greater New York area. And it just felt like these are all people who like we could have met at Shul. So that description to me, is very apt, but, right. You know, I really like the name, for the book Sledgehammer, and you had this really great story about why you chose the name. I know you don't want to get too much into the details of the books because you want people to buy it, but maybe you could share what the significance of that title is.
Sure. Well, you know, it really kind of harkens back to the City of David and our ability to make that incredibly important site accessible to U.S. government officials. When I got to Israel, not only was the City of David off limits and toxic to anybody in the U.S. government, but, you know, even when President Trump went to the Kotel in May of 2017, it was unprecedented for a sitting president to go. But of course, he could not be met there by any Israeli government officials because, God forbid, we should recognize the obvious that the Kotel is holy and historically critical to the Jewish people. So, you know, over the course of several years, as I learned more about the City of David and all that it represented, I mean, this is where, you know, the prophets of Israel preached, this is where the kings of Israel ruled, and it was so much more than a museum, right? Because you could go in there and actually, you know, immerse yourself in an environment that was 2,000 or more years old. So, you know, back in 2019, there was a major discovery that was opened up at the City of David. It's called the Pilgrimage Road. It's an actual intact flagstone road from the Pool of Siloam, which is at the foot of the, about, you know, down the hill from the southern wall of the temple. From that pool where Jews would come 2,000 years ago or more and purify themselves upon their trek to Jerusalem, there was this road, a fully intact road. It was underground, obviously, because of the years that have passed, but it was an underground road. And it went from the pool all the way up to the southern entrance to the temple. And so we had this ceremonial opening. And I brought, you know, everybody that I could that was available. I brought lots of ambassadors from other European countries. Jason came. I remember Senator Lindsey Graham came. And in order to kind of launch, you know, the ceremony, you know, sometimes you launch a ceremony by cutting a blue ribbon, whatever, here, because this was an underground tunnel. We had sort of a makeshift plasterboard wall, and we used a sledgehammer to open it. So I got the first swing of the sledgehammer, and I broke through the wall, and others took swings after me. And the New York Times was so irate with this event that it said, you know, I swing a sledgehammer and a metaphor is born. And the New York Times then used that metaphor, sledgehammer, to describe me over the next several years. And I thought it was, you know, an appropriate use of language to actually take that, which I think the Times obviously viewed as a criticism, but I actually viewed it as an asset because at the end of the day, all the things that we did on behalf of the State of Israel, on behalf of the U.S. relationship with the State of Israel, on behalf of the peace agreements that ultimately were reached between the State of Israel and five Muslim nations, all of that really required, you know, a sledgehammer, if you will. It required a very strong willingness to break with ways of the past. So while the sledgehammer at the City of David was a physical sledgehammer, you know, the book really refers to more to a metaphorical sledgehammer that we used to break with the past, whether it was with regard to Jerusalem, whether it was with regard to the Golan Heights, whether it was with regard to the legality of settlements, whether it was with regard to providing Jerusalemites with passports that said they were born in Israel, whether it was about a peace plan that did not call for the evacuation of settlements. All these things were so far different than prior U.S. policy. It really required a metaphorical sledgehammer to break with the past in order to move forward.
What do you attribute that to? Because there are people who say that, you guys came in, no experience in diplomacy, right? Maybe that was an advantage because people had tried to solve this conflict for so long in one way and they weren't succeeding. So you people came in from the Trump administration, tried to do things a little differently and shook things up and got some things done. But there are other people who claim over the years that you were pushing and directing the president in different directions, that it really wasn't him. He really didn't care, but it was mostly David Friedman.
Look, I think the president, has the world on his shoulders, literally. You know, he's responsible for lots and lots of things, and he relies on others when he seeks guidance in different areas. I mean, obviously, when it came to the U.S.-Israel relationship, it was my full-time job. It was not the president's full-time job, so he relied upon me, I think, to a large extent for guidance. But at the end of the day, he also wanted to understand the thinking that we had on every initiative we made. I was probed on on all these issues by the president, extensively. And, yeah, sure. I mean, I was pushing for all these things. I mean, these were all, if you will, agenda items that I came into office with, whether it was Jerusalem, the Golan Heights, the settlements, the plan, all those things. I mean, those were all things that were on my agenda, and I wanted to achieve them. But in order to achieve them, I had to convince the president that they were in the best interests of the United States, of the U.S.-Israel relationship. And so, the relationship was very much collaborative on these issues. The president certainly looked to me for guidance on all of them.
A lot of the book talks about the challenges you had sort of in dealing with other people in the administration or in Congress in trying to push forward the policies that you thought the U.S. should have towards Israel. And at the end of the day, the president often, and basically every case you mentioned in the book, does listen to you. So to what do you attribute that really high level of trust between you and former President Trump?
Well, look, I've known him for about 20 years. I was very fortunate in that when I represented him, which was not often, but, it was on, high profile matters. When I did represent him, I was blessed to have gotten good outcomes, very good results, in some cases, outcomes that exceeded my own expectations, to which I don't attribute to myself any particular skill. I actually, in the book, attributed it primarily to divine intervention, that God was able to solidify this relationship for things to come in the future. But I had credibility, certainly with him, maybe more so than any other lawyers that he had met or worked with. He was, and I was going to make sure that he was at all times familiar with my views. There were times when I was 6,000 miles away, and he'd be listening to people who I didn't agree with. Primarily in the early days with the then Secretary of State, Secretary Tillerson, and. It's a challenge when you're not in the room, you're far away, and you're 7 hours apart in time zone. So I made it my business to make sure that at all relevant times he was aware of my thinking. It rankled the institutional components of the State Department. The secretary wouldn't take my phone calls. He was very, very aggravated with me. I made it clear to him that I reported to the president, not to him. Which I don't think any ambassador has ever kind of challenged the Secretary of State and said, look, with all due respect, and I have great respect for your position, if you and I disagree, the president's going to hear my views. I'm not going to be funneled through you. So that's, there was some push and pull there. Look, I had the benefit of coming into this job with a lot of life experience, 35 years as a lawyer. I was almost 60. I was not going to kind of be pushed around, and it's not my nature anyway to get pushed around. And but I'm also, you know, extremely polite, you know. So, you know, in a polite way, I wanted to make sure that the president was well served, and I thought he would be best served if he listened to me. Obviously, he was always free to get other advice and to take a different tack, but I think he followed my advice, not necessarily because he liked me or respected me. He followed my advice because it was the right advice.
When you look back, David, at all of the different things that the Trump administration was able to get done, the recognition of Jerusalem, moving the embassy to Jerusalem, recognition of Israeli sovereignty of the Golan Heights, and many more initiatives, is there one that stands out as the highlight of your term as ambassador?
So I think there's one, because I think it really got everything else moving, and that is and I'll put them together as the recognition of Jerusalem and moving the embassy. The two went hand in hand. They were sort of multiple images of the same, you know, two sides of the same coin. The reason for that is because it was the first time that that the president made the decision, I'm going to keep my promise, I'm going to do what's right, I'm not going to be bullied by rogue nations or rogue actors or people who don't support the United States or have its best interest. I'm not going to cower in fear from a bunch of bad actors who are threatening me. I'm not going to be threatened. And I think when he did that, and it was sort of the first step, I think, was the boldest in terms of recognizing Jerusalem. The second step had important internal benefits, because the first step was the president says to the world, you know, I promised I would recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. I'm going to finally observe the mandate of the United States Congress, which recognized Jerusalem by overwhelming majorities. And I'm not going to be bullied by the Palestinians or other players in the region, or by the EU or otherwise, or the United Nations. So that, I think, was incredibly important. The second step, when he said, I'm going to move the embassy, in a very short period of time, he made the recognition in December of 2017. We moved the embassy roughly 5 months later on May 14th, 2018. That was a message to the State Department, to the internal apparatus of the United States, which is, you know, guys, don't get in my way. Because as I say in the book, the Secretary of State, you know, requested an analysis done before the embassy moved. That would have taken, just to write it, would have taken 2 years. It would have taken another, you know, number of years to implement it. I mean, it was clear to me that, you know, it was that he was slow rolling the process. And if he was able to control this process, even in a two-term presidency, I would never move into an embassy in Jerusalem. And so being able to work with the president to get that open that quickly was a message internally to the State Department. Guys, you know, get out of our way. You know, it won't make a difference. Get on board. You know, you've tried to block us. It's not working. Get on board. Make your lives easier. And so, you know, the messages were different, but equally important.
So the Abraham Accords take, I think, about two chapters in the book, maybe even more. And you talk a lot. I think you were really instrumental on the side of making sure Israel was on board, because at the time, the expectation, at least politically, was that Netanyahu was going to try to push through with the Israeli part of the peace plan with the Palestinians. He wanted to apply sovereignty to parts of Judea and Samaria. How difficult was it, I guess, or what was it like moving, sort of trying to get Netanyahu to move from that point where he expected to be moving forward with Judea and Samaria to this sort of new plan of, of normalizing ties with Arab states and putting the plan that he had really campaigned on in the election campaign that was ongoing, to put that on hold?
So it was difficult. It was a difficult time. It was the only difficult time in the relationship, and thank God it self-corrected fairly quickly. But, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the announcement of the peace plan in January of 2020, it was a difficult time. You know, there were lots and lots of factors, involved. I mean, as people know, I believe very strongly that Israel should, without specifying what the what the parameters should be, because I think that's Israel's decision, not mine. But I feel very strongly that Israel needs to begin to address in a serious way what its eastern border should look like. I mean, I think it's long enough. I mean, my advice to many Israelis is, look, if you don't decide for yourselves, somebody one day may decide for you. You're not going to like the decision. So, you know, this is sort of a third rail of Israeli politics, and it creates a lot of argument and dissent and a lot of strong feelings in favor. I mean, personally, I'm obviously, as people know, I'm in favor of Israel applying sovereignty to portions of Judea and Samaria. But I most importantly, I think that, you know, Israel has the, you know, democratic strength to address the issue, start thinking about it, making plans and convincing people what the right outcome is. So that was my view. Now, before we talk about, you know, 2020, you should know that, you know, Prime Minister Netanyahu has been an advocate for, as people speak shorthand, you know, peace from the outside in. He's been advocating that since before I came around. You know, he's been saying for many, many years that that there will come a day when Israel will make peace with Arab nations in the Gulf, even without a deal with the Palestinians. Now, people said he was crazy and it would never happen, but he's been an advocate of that for many years. So to a certain extent, you know, it was far from a defeat for Netanyahu to have the Abraham Accords. I mean, as I discussed this with him over many, you know, sessions, it was very much in keeping with his own view of the of how the region should progress. It was the politics of the time that made this so complicated and difficult. And, you know, look, you know, I've given you the plus side for sovereignty. The downside was that because of the political environment, it was like a tiger without a tail. It was just it was moving in so many directions at the same time. You had so many people kind of trying to own it and manage it. You know, as you recall, there were people on the right that said, we love the sovereignty, we hate the plan. Well, you know, that's exactly the wrong message to send to the United States, that, you know, we're going to take what we like, but we're going to throw away the stuff that we don't like, because that's not how this was presented. It was presented as a peace plan or a potential peace plan with a component that included sovereignty, not a sovereignty plan where, if you know, you'll also, you know, there was an option to make peace. That wasn't the structure of it. So it was kind of mangled, you know, from the beginning. You add to that the fact that COVID was just starting, and you know, as you know, what COVID looked like in March, April, May of 2020, it completely took all the oxygen out of the room for anything else. I mean, nobody had any appetite for anything, you know, super controversial. And so, you know, we were looking at the Israeli polling. Even the Israeli polling was, you know, found this to be at the time an irritant rather than a great opportunity. And of course, the main thing was, you know, we had a government at the time which came together with, you know, Netanyahu, Gantz, and Ashkenazi. And bottom line is that Ashkenazi and Gantz were against sovereignty. Could they have come on board under circumstances where they had greater faith that Netanyahu would honor their deal? Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of friction there unrelated to sovereignty. But the playing field that we were dealing with was the prime minister was in favor, the foreign minister was against, and the defense minister was against. So how do you move forward with something this controversial where two-thirds of your leadership is against it, the polls are against it, COVID has captivated everybody's attention, and very few people are really advocating for the plan as opposed to just the provisions of the plan that they like? So the challenge is really, and you know, I'm not sure what was more important, you know, which one of these things was more of an issue, but they all came together in sort of a perfect storm.
You know, you kind of touched upon this just now, but how much did the political instability in Israel play a role in getting things done, or the inability to get some things done?
I think it had a huge impact, and it created a lot of confusion. I mean, on the one hand, you have people on the far right. Maybe I wouldn't call them the far right because, you know, ideologically, I'm not that far from where they are. But you had people, you know, who were, you know, sort of the Land of Israel movement was absolutely against the plan, you know, extremely against the plan, to the point where they were lobbying the American evangelical movement to tell the president the plan's no good, you know, which is one of the president's largest voter bases. So, you know, they're doing everything they can to make the plan, you know, look unattractive. So that's on one side of it. The other side of it is you have you know, as I mentioned, this instability between the three primary ministers within the Israeli government. Two out of three are against it, and they're all, I think, waiting to see, because I think from their perspective, they're, you know, Gantz and Ashkenazi are not going to give what they would consider to be a political gift to Netanyahu under circumstances where there might be another election and he might not go forward.
Is this what contributed to that recording that now has become famous of where the former president uses profanity when talking about Netanyahu? Do you think that the...
And also said that Netanyahu doesn't want peace.
Right. Do you think that's because maybe of this political instability that was here over that period of time?
Actually, no, because I think the president's anger... Look, the president, I think he saw the speech that Netanyahu gave in January of 2020. I think he thought the speech sounded a lot too much like a campaign speech and too much like a sovereignty speech rather than a peace speech. I mean, that's the way he heard it. I heard it a little bit differently. I wasn't offended by the speech, but I think the president was, and you know, he had to stand there and listen to what I think he really perceived as a campaign speech. So I think that was a factor. I mean, the president has been told by, you know, people that he knows that are not fans of Netanyahu, that Netanyahu doesn't want peace. But at the end of the day, the real factor that I think caused the president's ire was Netanyahu's congratulations to Biden on video, which, I'm certainly not critical of that. I think Israel has to maintain a relationship, an important, strong, critical relationship with the United States, no matter who the president is. But I think the video kind of struck the president as a little bit over the top, given how close they had been. I think the president understood the politics. I just don't think he liked the video. And I actually think that was the primary factor.
Hmm. And now that we are a year into the Biden administration, what grade would you give it when it comes to Israel?
It's probably...
You're not suddenly becoming a diplomat, David, are you?
No, I'm just saying. What I'm trying to figure out is, do they get a D or do they get an incomplete? That's what I'm wrestling with. I think that the way the relationship right now is playing out, let's leave Iran out of it for a second, because there I have strong criticisms of the Biden administration. But I think on everything else, what you're seeing is on the Israeli side, I think, you know, the message to the U.S. is, leave us alone. We've got a very fragile government. Okay. We're not going to do anything particularly controversial, you know, to the right or to the left. And if you push us too hard, Netanyahu is going to come back and you'll be sorry. That's the message, I think, from the Israeli government. And I think the U.S. is perfectly happy to live within that, live within that world, because, frankly, the U.S. has so many massive problems right now. Domestically, obviously, you got a failing economy, you know, rampant inflation, and a border that's out of control, massively rising crime rate, inflation, supply chain issues, massively low, unprecedented low polling. So the last thing that the Biden administration really needs to do right now is pick a fight with Israel. And the last thing they want to do is to push Israel to the point where the government falls. So it's really an incomplete, you know, more than anything else. I think they're just sort of, you know, tap dancing around each other. As far as Iran is concerned, I think that there I would give the U.S. an F, because they have relieved Iran already of sanctions. They've got nothing for it. They're chasing Iran. They're not going to get anything worthwhile by chasing Iran. They have massive leverage over Iran that they're refusing to use. So I just don't see how anything that they're doing will get us to, you know, what I would call JCPOA plus, right? I mean, I think You know, anybody who reads it knows that the JCPOA is a flawed and bad agreement. You know, you could revise it and get to JCPOA plus and maybe have something that's worth keeping, or you could do what the Biden's doing now and probably get to JCPOA minus, which is where I think we're headed.
And they also want to reverse your sort of flagship achievements as ambassador, and or not totally reverse, but slightly reverse, by opening a consulate for the Palestinians in Jerusalem, which Israel has argued sort of scales back the recognition of Israel, of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. What do you think about that?
Well, it definitely does. I mean, I've publicly advocated against that in lots of different publications. Look, there's no reason at all why we should have a consulate to the Palestinians at all. We don't recognize the Palestinians as having a state. So I don't know why we would open up a diplomatic mission to a non-state. On top of that, I don't know why we would do it in Jerusalem. Abbas never comes to Jerusalem. You want to meet with Abbas, meet with him in Ramallah, where he hangs out, or maybe Bethlehem, but certainly not in Jerusalem. I'll tell you, and the Israelis have the right to say no. Personally, I hope they do, whether it's Bennett or Saar or Lapid. I mean, they've all said the answer is no. So I don't see any legal way for the U.S. to proceed with it. I hope the U.S. doesn't threaten Israel with something like this. And the other thing, though, is the consulate is, it's not just me. If you go back and ask my predecessors, they all didn't like the consulate, because the consulate is an independent diplomatic mission that does not report to the embassy, does not report to the ambassador, and it's situated in Israel's capital. So every time the ambassador to Israel travels to Jerusalem, which is at least 3 or 4 times a week, to meet with Israeli officials, he's now stepping on into the territory controlled by the consul general, which doesn't report to him and doesn't even report to the president. So over the years, the amount of friction between the consulate and the embassy is very well known. It's not served our diplomatic interests at all. And whether it's for legal reasons, whether it's because it would divide Jerusalem against the wishes of the American people and the Jerusalem Embassy Act, or because it's simply a bad policy, a bad practice, I don't think this should open.
To just wrap things up, I was looking at the, and people should know, the book is coming out in just a few days. You can get it on all the websites, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. There's also a website that you've created called sledgehammerbook.com. And I was looking before through the gallery. You have a lot of pictures there. And maybe I'm reading a bit too much into things. But I noticed a lot of pictures of you with Mike Pompeo. I noticed, obviously, a lot of pictures with the President Trump. A lot of pictures with Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, and a lot of pictures with Nikki Haley, the former ambassador to the United Nations, four people who could potentially run for president. So does this mean that we're on good terms with everybody?
Oh, I'm on great terms with all of them. I consider the president, the vice president, secretary of state, Ambassador Haley, Governor DeSantis, I consider them all dear friends. I work with them all very closely over the last 5 years, including when the Governor DeSantis was in Congress. As you remember, he was one of the leaders in Congress to get the embassy moved to Jerusalem. They're all dear friends, incredible people. And look, I had thousands more pictures, so I figured I'd include the ones of the people that I liked the best.
I got it. Well, David Friedman, the former U.S. ambassador to Israel, whose new book, Sledgehammer, is coming out in just a few days. Pick up your copy for a real insider's look of what happened here over the last few years when the Trump administration, together with the state of Israel, was making some dramatic changes, not just to the state of Israel, but also to the Middle East. Thanks a lot for joining us on the Jerusalem Post podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. We're here every week. If you enjoyed it, please send the link to your family and friends. We're available on all the major podcast platforms.